underneath the concrete jungle of Kalamazoo. Anarchy on the airway.
The People's Power Hour on 89.1 WIDR.
Now, he's a spoiled brat. Tried the nice guy who replaced him cooperating with the president.
Are now honored to have the voice and the person behind the voice of Jeff Schmidt, physicist and social critic, author of Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at the Salary Professionals and the Soul Battering System that Shaped Their Lives. Jeff was on the editorial staff of Physics Today for 19 years until he was fired for writing the book we'll be talking about today, which was a thought-provoking examination of the politics of education and employment. Mr. Schmidt has a PhD, we could call him Dr. Schmidt, in physics from the University of California, Irvine, and has taught in the United States, Central America, and Africa. Physics Today magazine, where Dr. Schmidt worked, is published by the American Institute of Physics, which is governed by the American Physical Society and other physics organizations. To date, nearly 1,000 people in a wide range of fields have condemned the American Institute of Physics for firing Dr. Schmidt over this book, and this includes more than 500 physicists, the largest number of physicists ever to speak out on a freedom of expression issue in the United States. Dr. Schmidt, welcome to the People's Power Hour. Hello, Dr. Schmidt. Thank you, Dan. Dr. Schmidt, are you with us?
I am, and it's an honor to be on your show.
So, let's begin.
Dr. Schmidt, I was wondering if maybe we could start out, you could tell us a little bit about how this process all started, maybe as a graduate student at UC Irvine studying physics and the political climate you encountered there and how you dealt with that.
Certainly. When I arrived at the University of California, Irvine, to be a physics graduate student, I immediately encountered a bunch of stressed-out graduate students and a generally repressive atmosphere. I remember walking in and seeing one of the graduate students packing up his books because he had just been kicked out of physics graduate school because of this qualification examination they had given. So I laid low for a while until they passed me on that examination, and then I became more active politically. I had been active politically even when I was laying low, but I confined my activity to areas outside of the physics department. But once they passed me on that exam, I helped form a chapter of the Science for the People organization, which was a group that was questioning the largely military orientation of scientific research and so on, and we were very active in the department and on campus. For example, when the head of the Los Alamos Nuclear Weapons Laboratory was brought to the department to speak, we confronted him and asked him why he had lobbied in favor of the neutron bomb. And this was very embarrassing for his hosts who were, you know, who had their ideas of how you treat the head of a national laboratory. You don't ask probing questions like that.
So
but,
can you...
They finally did give me my degree, in part to get rid of me, and then I went to work at Physics Today magazine. I had been in the working world before physics graduate school, and getting back into it at Physics Today really reminded me of what bothered me about the whole work situation. Basically, I wrote this book, Disciplined Minds, because I got fed up with ass-kissers at work. I hope you're allowed to use that word on your radio program. especially the well-educated ones, the salaried professionals. These were people who would never express an opinion that might displease people above them in the workplace hierarchy. No matter what the issue, you could count on that. And later I realized that the bosses did count on that. They expected their professionals to be politically subordinate experts. not independent thinkers. Fortunately, on most jobs, I found a tiny minority of independent thinkers in this vast sea of spineless intellectual workers. And I discovered that these intellectually and politically subordinate individuals are deliberately produced. That's what my graduate school experience taught me. I had wondered, where do these people come from? And then when I went to graduate school, I saw where they come from. They're deliberately produced, and that was a big motivation for me to write this book. My own training was in science, and I saw the best of my fellow graduate students being kicked out of the program or dropping out on their own, having read the writing on the wall. Those were the students who were the most concerned about other people and about society seemed to be the most likely to disappear. The system favored self-centered, narrowly focused students.
So can you talk to us a bit about the relationship between science and the military?
Well, my own field, physics, is closely tied to the military. It's almost 100% tied to the federal government. Almost 100% of physics research in the United States is federally funded, even at the university level, through contracts and grants. And there's a whole military atmosphere in physics departments. One day our Science for the People organization brought a speaker to the physics department for a lunch meeting. This was a science and society seminar we had started, and the speaker was from a different department, sociology, and I think we entered the building. I walked him over from sociology to the physics building, and as we entered the building, there was a clock there that said 12:01, and he looked up at the clock, and he said, "Oh, we're on time." And I said, "No, we're 1 minute late." And this illustrated the difference between the cultures of sociology and physics. And he ended up using this as an example in his talk, which really upset some of the physicists who didn't like to be likened to the military culture.
And we are speaking with Dr. Jeff Schmidt, the physicist and social critic, author of Disciplined Minds, a book which he was, disciplined for from the editorial staff of Physics Today magazine. I'm sorry, Dr. Schmidt, when exactly were you in graduate school?
Well, this was in the 1970s.
So in a time of, you know, social upheaval and a lot of criticism to the government and a lot of that issuing from university campuses. Is it in your opinion? Do you think has the climate on university campuses changed? We've talked with a lot of academics and talked about a lot of academics that are currently having a lot of issues. I mean, Ward Churchill being one. We spoke with David Graeber, who was under disciplinary action at Yale because of his political beliefs. I mean, is this something that's being stepped up on campuses?
Well, I don't think it's being stepped up, but the resistance to it has been decreasing. I think that's what happened. And David Graeber is not fortunate enough to be under disciplinary procedures at Yale. I think they just fired him without any procedures at all. And the problem is the lack of resistance to that kind of repression. That repression is common, and it's something we expect in a hierarchical system, right? But what really upsets us is the lack of resistance to it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm demanding my job back at Physics Today magazine, and people ask me, well, would you really want to go back to that repressive place? And my answer is that, well, you'd be naive to expect the bosses to be good guys, you know. And I'm used to working in repressive places. What I want is some resistance to it. That's some resistance to the repression.
I was curious. You talked about how graduate school, you know, effectively shapes conformists as opposed to critical thinkers. What role do examinations play in that? That's something you write about quite a bit in your book.
Yeah, I spend more than one chapter on examinations, in particular this qualification examination, which all graduate students have to pass to be allowed to go on to get their PhD. There's a lot of weeding and transformation that happens around examinations, and I use the qualification exam as an example, but really all exams share a lot of these same characteristics. These big exams, these big high-stakes exams, terrorize the student with the threat of expulsion. The process of preparing for these tests, because of the kind of questions on the tests and the way they have to be answered, really alienates the students from the subjects that they went into because of love of these subjects. The tests emphasize quick recall, memorized tricks, mathematical tricks, work on detached problems, separated from their social origin, work under time pressure, sheer endurance, quantitative results, comfort with confinement to details, comfort with the whole social framework of the test and course and institution, comfort with the hierarchical division of labor because tests usually emphasize theory over experiment, at least in the sciences. The tests de-emphasize qualitative discussion, physical insight, exploration, curiosity, creativity, history, philosophy, and so on. And this forces the student who wants to be passed to adopt an instrumental view of the subject, to basically view the subject as a tool, to use it in a way that's not intrinsically satisfying in an alienated way. And that is not an accident. That's good preparation for most employment. Because employers don't want philosophers or critics. They want people who can churn out the work and not be distracted by their own thoughts about it.
That's interesting because, you know, many scientists, I think of themselves as self-directed, kind of autonomous researchers, don't they?
They certainly do, and they try to maintain that self-image. It's very important to them. But they're not really self-directed at all. In my book, I describe how the military funding agencies, such as the Air Force Office of Scientific Research, the Navy and the Army Offices of Scientific Research, how they direct the curiosity of physics researchers by making money available in certain areas. If the Army Research Office, for example, makes $10 million available in a particular area of physics, a lot of physicists will find, well, gee, I am interested in that. That's kind of interesting. And they'll send in their grant applications. So their curiosity is directed, but it's directed in a way that allows them to think that they are self-directed.
Well, and this is also something that we're seeing mirrored in the workplace, a lot of emphasis on people no longer are employees. They're what's the word?
Associates
and things like that. And some sort of like the vestiges of self-management being put out there to employees. Is that also being done in the in graduate schools and the academic world?
Well, I think they've done that all along. In the academic world, that pretense. I know about the associates and the partners at various companies. It seems like the more their work is standardized and made into a formula, the more the employer has to give them some kind of indication that they're really independent and self-directed.
If in name alone, right?
I was curious, so what are some of the resistance strategies? I found it was interesting in your book you actually refer people that are working within professional organizations to check out Field Manual 21-78, Prisoner of War Resistance, put out by the U.S. Army.
Yes, that's right. That's both serious and humorous at the same time. What happened was my interviews with students led me to the strange idea that cult indoctrination might shed light on professional training and graduate school, because many of the students' experiences in graduate school sounded like what goes on in organizations that are accused of brainwashing, so-called brainwashing their members into unthinking clones. So I looked into the techniques that totalitarian organizations use to get people to play a politically subordinate role, and I found that professional training programs use the same techniques. These include, for example, recruitment through big promises, social isolation through milieu control, setting up teachers as unquestioned authority, undermining true self-confidence, and a gross exaggeration of the importance of the work to the world. And after seeing that similarity to cult indoctrination, I thought, well, how can this be resisted? And that's when I discovered this Army manual called Prisoner of War Resistance, in which the Army trains its people how to resist indoctrination if they are captured and made prisoners of war. And I found that these techniques applied very well to graduate school and the workplace and any hierarchical repressive situation. So I wrote in my book that the United States Army issued a survival manual for graduate school without knowing it. And in fact, in a crucial way, the military manual is better than civilian advice books, which are written specifically for students. These civilian books help you conform to the demands of the institution. You get your credential, but you lose your identity in the process. However, the Army manual shows you how to survive the training program and keep control over your identity. The military even has a name for it. They call it honorable survival. And we need more honorable survival in our educational institutions.
You know, this show has done a number of... we used to do a yearly workplace sabotage, workplace resistance show. And in researching those shows, you know, there are a number of corporations and businesses set up to defuse workplace tension and defuse, you know, people who would sabotage workplaces. You mentioned that you know, resistance to this hierarchy is being reduced. Is it, you know, is it being reduced, or has it gone more underground? Are people more quiet about it, individualistic about it, rather than kind of the large group type resistance that we see in, you know, in the labor history, etc.?
Well, people are still dissatisfied, but they're seeking individual solutions, and there isn't much sabotage or whatever going on because people feel weak and isolated. There's really no substitute for organization, but people are tremendously dissatisfied, and from time to time they do some things that you might call sabotage that just reduce the productivity of the place. This is pretty well documented in the Dilbert comic strip, but I would say there's no substitute for organizing, mm-hmm. and there's less organizing now. The formal organizing, which is unionization, is down way low. I think 7 out of 8 workers are not in unions at this time.
It's interesting, though, we're talking about graduate school and union organizing, and, of course, graduate students have been organizing unions. What potential do you see there?
That's great. I think that's a good first step, and I would like to see those unions go beyond wages and working conditions and talk about the actual content of the graduate programs and stand up for the rights of the students in disputes that arise over the actual content of the training. This is what the universities feared in the graduate organizing. They feared that it would lead to that, and I hope it does lead to that.
Speaking of resistance strategies, you list a number of them, several pages worth, towards the end of your book. And just to give one example, you suggest to, quote, blow the whistle and sabotage projects that are against the public interest. You act as a radical professional for a fair social structure, even at your employer's expense. You do this, for example, by leaking plans and other information to opposition organizations or to the press. In the case of the press, you make it the radical press, not only to avoid an innocuous treatment of the issue, but also to build the radical press. When this activity becomes widespread, all segments of society will see the radical press as required reading. I was wondering, were a number of these survival strategies for radicals finding themselves working in the professions, did this have something to do with Physics Today taking the action that it did?
Well, actually, yeah, in the book I list 33 suggestions of things you can do on the job to further your own agenda, which I think you have a moral right to do, and I can explain why I think that in a minute. But yes, I tried out, over the 19 years I was there, I tried out most of these 33 techniques and didn't get fired. They fired me when I published the list. So you don't have to publish the list. However, you do take a risk in doing these things, but I argue that you take a much bigger risk by not resisting, because at stake is your is not just the nature of the workplace and society, but your own nature as well, your very identity. And if you conform, you're losing control of your identity. The system of education and employment works to define or redefine who you are in the deepest sense, pushing you away from developing and acting on your own vision and guiding ideas. So if you want to stand for something and avoid vanishing as an independent force in society, you really have no choice but to become an activist and resist. And yes, resisting the system carries some risk, but I think not resisting is a far deadlier course for your individual identity.
And we are talking to Dr. Jeff Schmidt, author of Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System that Shapes Their Lives. Anyone interested in checking out more about this book and Dr. Schmidt can look at www.disciplinedminds.com.
Dr. Schmidt, you've had a number of people, including a thousand physicists, come to your side in this struggle that you have been embroiled in. I mean, including Noam Chomsky and other noted people. What's the, you know, from the physicist community and the we've seen a lot of outpouring of support for you. What's been the support outside of the academic and scientific communities?
Well, it's been pretty good, actually. There's more support outside of the highly educated community. These highly educated people, as I explain in the book, tend to be conservative and not to speak out. Nevertheless, 500 physicists have spoken out, in part because they thought that my firing hurt them by tarnishing the image of physics. Remember, they have this image of physics as being this institution where people freely pursue their ideas, there's free debate and so on. So when physics institutions act like repressive institutions in other fields, this upsets physicists and physicists who want to think that physics is better in those areas. But outside of the highly educated people, there's been a lot of support among those who have found out about my dismissal. Of course, most people haven't heard anything about this at all.
Well, and is that because you think it's outside of their kind of realm of what they're looking at? I mean, this has definitely not been something that's been covered on, or has it been, on, you know, NPR or other major news sources.
No, it hasn't been covered.
So unless you're looking for this, it's hard to find.
Right, right, yeah.
Well, I guess we're happy to be able to bring it to the attention of the Kalamazoo listening public, if nothing else.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, that's really, that's troubling to me that, you know, because, well, here in Kalamazoo, Pat Buchanan came to speak, and at the end of his talk, someone doused him with salad dressing, and that was a huge uproar. That was in all the news. I mean, you know, CNN, everyone was carrying it as, you know, some sort of horrific, wet blanket over free speech. But issues like yours, or Churchill's, and others, other academics who are being, from the left especially, who are being charged with, speaking out, that is not making the news.
Yeah, that's right. And the real lack of free speech is the lack of free speech at the place where people have their greatest interaction with society, which is on the job.
Mm-hmm.
You essentially check your free speech rights when you walk into the workplace. Here in Washington, D.C., you can literally see free speech rights being cut back. For example, a couple years ago, police surrounded an entire anti-World Bank rally and arrested everybody there. They arrested 650 people. They arrested the entire rally. And based on the theory that the intent of the group, as the police chief said, was to disrupt the city, which is illegal, he said. And there was very little outrage against that. There is a court case which is proceeding, but as far as public outrage at the violation of free speech, not much. And I think there's a reason for that. It's because very few people ever exercise their right of free expression, and so losing the right is no big deal to them. Most people go their entire lives without ever speaking out in a way that would get them into trouble if the First Amendment wasn't there to protect them. Activists are really the only people who truly understand these things. So we need to get more people to become activists.
So it's interesting you just mentioned the World Bank. I was curious how institutions like that play a role in exporting to the world this, Western style of professionalization, which does so much to keep people from becoming activists, and that, you know, it sort of indoctrinates them in quite the opposite direction.
I don't know that much about the World Bank, but there's a good example of what you just said within the bank itself. The staff of the World Bank is very, very liberal. They're very much opposed to the war in Iraq, for example. And now we have a new head of the World Bank who is an architect of the war in Iraq. You might think this would cause a big problem, but it will not cause a big problem. Those professionals will check their own ideas at the door, and they will carry out Wolfowitz's policies as good professionals. Mm-hmm. And of course, I call upon professionals to pursue their own ideology and their own goals, own vision.
I was just wondering how this all might fit into this, this rhetoric we always hear of development, in that, if perhaps the problems of the third world result from a shortage of, the proper style of education or what have you.
Yeah, the World Bank does play a big role in world education, and they have a model that's pretty much the American model. They want to replace people who staff governments in other countries with bureaucrats who score well on tests, people who have no vision of their own but who are good at following a vision that's dictated by the person at the top. And so they're introducing these kinds of exams around the world.
So what can people do who want to perhaps sign a petition in support of you? Can they do that at the Disciplined Minds website, disciplinedminds.com?
Yes, indeed. Yep, they can add their name to the letter that Noam Chomsky solicited signatures on, and other letters there. Also, the email address of the head of the American Institute of Physics, Mark Brodsky, is there. You can send him a note saying you heard it on WIDR and and you're not happy about it, and this. Send a copy of that note to me. My email address is there, and I'll post it on the web. That's disciplinedminds.com.
And that's, yes, exactly, found on the web. And there are chapters from your book there as well for people interested in looking into this a little bit more. Well, Dr. Schmidt, we'd like to thank you for not silencing your free speech and for speaking out and for being willing to come here on the People's Power Hour tonight. It's been a pleasure for us.
Well, it's been a pleasure for me. Congratulations on your radio activism, and keep up the good work.
We'll do our best. Again, this has been Dr. Jeff Schmidt, the author of Disciplined Minds, a critical look at Sally professionals and the soul battering system that shapes their lives. For more information, see him on the web at Disciplined Minds. That's one word, disciplinedminds.com. Once again, Dr. Schmidt, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.